Dude, I'm wondering whether you could recall in what circumstances you first met Isaiah.
Well, I first met him at Oxford when he was at Corpus Christi and I was at UNIF. I can't remember the exact circumstances, but we saw each other quite a lot at Oxford. We'd go for walks, I think, and well, that's all right.
You can't remember the year, can you?
Yeah, well, yes, it would be either 1928 or 1929.
Yes.
When I think I went up, well, if I went up and it was my second year, I can't remember whether I went up in 1927 or 1928.
What clubs or classes or tutorials would have put you together with him?
There weren't any clubs or tutorials. We just met. I think there was a certain. I knew one or two people. There was a poet called Bernard Spencer, who I think also was at Corpus, and maybe Bernard introduced me to Isaiah.
Yeah.
But Isaiah was quite a he was quite a famous undergraduate. People, they were famous among a small set of people. I mean, people would talk about Isaiah. And
famous for what?
For talking a great deal, right. And for being amusing and intelligent, and a rather sort of, I think, sought out, I think.
As in other words, right from the beginning, not
right? I think right from the beginning, yes. I don't think that we thought of Isaiah as going to have at all a public future. In fact, I think one thought of him as a scholar and a very intelligent and civilized conversationalist with an interesting background, of course, from Riga and so on. But one certainly didn't think him. So one thought of him as remaining Don, I think.
Yes. What impression did he make on you when you first met, or when an impression began to crystallize?
Well, I think we immediately liked one another very much, and we got on very well. And he seemed to have a peculiar—I could never understand. I mean, I'm very grateful to his attitude to me. He's always been very protective to me, and.
Why protective?
I think he's always regarded me as a person who might get himself into trouble, and I think ever since he's always regarded me as a person who always has to be paid for. I always have great difficulty when I with that Zion ever. It's a rather joke ever paying for anything.
I see. Yeah.
And so he has been rather.
Do you think his impression of you is warranted? Or does it irk you slightly that he regards you in this light?
No, I'm rather grateful. I imagine he regards me as a person who does sort of foolish things, you know, Spanish Civil War, joining the communists at one time. And he has I think probably he feels that he knows me very well. He knew that I was never a communist and could possibly be a communist.
No.
So he has a view of me. He thinks he has to protect me from myself, I should think.
Do you think he's right in that? Do you think his judgment of you is accurate? Do you look to him as someone who is an accurate mirror of your own character?
He's quite different from my other friends, and I have a friendship with him which is quite apart from my friendship with, say, Warden, Isherwood, Cyril Connolly, all sorts of other people who are my friends, some of whom he wouldn't care about very much. I don't think he'd care about Cyril Connolly, for instance.
What would make his friendship, your friendship with him, different than your friendship with the others?
I should think we, I feel we understand each other very well. I don't know whether that's part being partly Jewish on my part or something like that, but I feel we have a sort of friendship which is apart from our friendship with either of us with anyone else, really.
Let me ask you, what physical impression he made upon you when you saw him when he was a very young man? What did he look like to you?
I think his... I was thinking as I came along, someone described him as looking like a baby elephant. And I think that's rather a good description of how he looked, especially the sort of... I mean, it was like, in relation to the grown-up Isaiah, he was like a sort of smaller version of his present self. And one can imagine a kind of series, receding series, in which Isaiah somehow would be born, say, at the age of 40 or something like that, but that he would be a diminutive version which would grow and grow and acquire more knowledge and so on. Yeah. I think that his friends always regarded him, I mean, sort of cherished a kind Isaiah partly as a kind of one side of him as a sort of joke figure, precisely because of that, because there was some sense that he'd always been exactly the same, just a sort of that he'd always had a sort of rather adult mind. So, in fact, I mean, Isaiah to be playing around would seem something to be remarked on. I mean, I remember once going to some party in which Isaiah became very sort of frolicsome and stood on a seat, in a window seat, throwing cherries at people from a sort of little...
But this seemed highly uncharacteristic.
Well, this people would notice Isaiah, I mean, if anyone else had done it, it wouldn't have been a matter of remark, but I mean, everyone enjoyed Isaiah being so sort of frolicsome. Yeah. I mean, in that respect, rather like one would Dr. Johnson, let's say.
Yeah. But to pursue that point a little further, you convey the impression of a young man who is preternaturally grown up when all you undergraduates are much more kind of callow, and that made him in a sense of fun. Does that mean that he seemed to be a person who'd had no childhood, that he seemed...
Well, I think one would feel a bit about him like that, and also, of course, very cosmopolitan. I mean, coming out of a much wider world than we did. But also, I think at St. Paul's, I mean, friends of his, like John Davenport, or people who knew him at St. Paul's, Arthur Caldermarsh, I think, would say Isaiah was exactly the same, and would sort of joke about. I mean, as though they were talking about the adult Isaiah being a kind of schoolboy, but exactly the same as he was when he was adult. And that's
yes.
That sort of joke.
Yes. I'm wondering whether, because in your autobiography you say immediately Isaiah was from Riga, and could I assume from that you knew very quickly where he came from, or should I assume on the contrary that he was rather guarded about his background and origins? What did he tell you about himself?
Well, he talked about his parents, who lived in Hollycroft Avenue, and I visited him. I mean, we saw each other in the holidays quite a lot, because I lived in Hampstead and he lived in Hampstead. And so we'd see each other in the vacation, and I'd go to his house. I knew his mother, who was enormously proud of him. Later on, I caused tremendous offence, and I never quite see why. That shows this sort of touchiness of Isaiah and the whole family, I suppose. But I think Isaiah was a bit annoyed about it, because when he got a knighthood, I thought he wouldn't want to be congratulated on getting a knighthood. So I wrote to his mother and congratulated her. They were all rather annoyed by this, I think. I think Isaiah thought it was a kind of malicious joke.
Oh, really?
Or something, yes.
I mean, it's rather nice to write someone's mother.
Exactly, that's what I thought, to write to, that I knew he wouldn't want to be written to.
Yes. Well, I think he was touchy on the whole subject, wasn't he?
Yes, touchy on the whole subject, yes. But, I mean, I think there's a certain lack of assurance somehow about it. I mean, underneath all his cleverness and everything and his wisdom and so on, that there's a certain lack of security, or lack of a certain, almost like a feeling that he's a stranger in England, a certain outsider quality about Isaiah, which I think is partly why, I mean, the thing that he was reproached by Roger Scruton or someone for the other day, which is partly why he's very hesitant about taking up sort of public attitudes, anything.
Yes.
And I always trace that back to his to his roots, really.
Mm. I'm interested in his Jewishness and your part Jewishness. I mean, how did you establish that as a bond very quickly?
No.
Or did it only gradually come out? That
no, I don't. I think he would talk about, I mean, I don't think I'm even very, I wouldn't be conscious in the same way as he would, I don't think, anyhow. But the Jews are certainly the subject that he's enormously interested in, and that he talks about a lot.
But did he talk a lot about it at that time when he was a much, much younger man?
I think we always talked about everything. Of course, he talked a great deal, then we went for a walking tour, Isaiah and I. But when was that? That wasn't until much later, till the 1950s sometime. The war. I think it was just right after the war, he'd remember. We went to the Lake District and we went for about a week's walk. And then he talked a great deal about music, I mean about Mozart and so on. And I mean, he was always, as I was always prepared to give to treat anything as a subject. And I mean, actually, he treated. Last week when we met at lunch, he treated how to get from my house to the Brendel's house, St. John's, which is an extraordinarily difficult journey. And
as a subject,
as
you
subject.
Discussed relatively efficient ways to do the same.
Yes, I mean, whether you should go, so I don't know, take the tube to go. He first of all said take the tube to Golders Green, then take a bus, and that wouldn't do. Then you'd go to, on the contrary, you could go to Oxford Circus.
Yeah.
Change Rock Circus, change Tottenham Court Road, yeah. And so on. And I mean, Isaiah can
spin get anything out.
Yes, you can get very much on stuff. David Hockney made a very nice remark about Isaiah. He said, you know, what he liked about Isaiah was he talked to anyone about anything. He'd be chatting away, talking away to David. And David was doing drawings of him, and then the cleaning lady would come in, and as I would start talking to the cleaning lady about detergents, then
yes, that's very characteristic. Can you remember what you used to talk about in your very early days?
Well, it's so difficult to say because you see. We couldn't really. I mean, I suppose I think that Isaiah would always ask, if asked, explain everything. I mean, I know more what he talked about than what I talked about. I mean, I can't imagine that we talked about philosophy. Although I think Isaiah did explain to me once after he came back from Harvard, how someone had told him he couldn't possibly be a philosopher because he could only be a historian of philosophy, and so on. But I mean, I seem very incapable of abstract thinking. I mean, that's why I've always wondered why Isaiah was, I mean, seemed so attached to me. I've always thought, well, what is it really? That I don't really know anything about his particular subjects, you right. see.
Well,
he might see me as a kind of Russian figure, perhaps, in a Hudson or something. That's possibly.
Yes. But do you think he was attached to your poetry? Was that fun?
I don't think he likes poetry very much.
But music?
Music, absolutely, yes. Always very. But it always seems to me that the talk has come more from his side. As a matter of fact, he's not a terribly good listener, I don't think. He's a person who can start off. And then, but I always find if I'm going to tell Isaiah an anecdote, I spend about 10 minutes mentally trying to package it into as minute a space as possible so that I can squeeze it in.
Yes. And get some, have some expectation that he'll actually listen to it.
Yes.
I'm trying to chart your relationship to him in the very dim and distant past. You say you had walks with him. Can you remember any other things that you did with him in this early period when you were at UNIV, Oxford, 1929, 1930, 1931?
We wrote a lot of letters. I have an awful feeling that I have lost his early letters to me. I keep on worrying about that. I know I did have them up to the war. Mm-hmm. But very, very interesting. I mean, hundreds of them. Mm-hmm. And we certainly conducted a correspondence. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know,
between like, where and where would those?
I'd be in Germany, for instance.
Yeah.
I think he must have thought me as a kind of person who sort of lived rather, you know, sort of went out into life and kind of did rash things.
Mm.
He probably thought.
Yes. And conversely, you would think of him as someone who stayed in his shell, stayed in the cloister.
Yes.
Never took risks.
Well, it wouldn't worry me that, but. I suppose that's so. I would have thought of him as a scholar and a writer. I think that Isaiah, there's a side of Isaiah which thinks of himself as a kind of scholar working in a garret, and this scholar ought to be like a sort of scholar in a Russian novel or something, working in a garret in a Russian novel, and have written the history of thought apart political, or perhaps politics is something we had of interest in common, yes, certainly. The history of the thought of people like Lamartine or someone like that,
yes.
Sort of literary figures,
yeah.
who went into politics, you see, intellectuals who went into some kind of political action.
Did he see himself that way at any point, do you think?
I think he did seriously think of doing that. Well, I think he was thinking of writing such a book in several volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he feels, I think Isaiah might feel he's betrayed some kind of vocation, but I mean, who doesn't think they've had betrayed?
Mm-hmm. What kind of vocation do you think he's betrayed? Just
as this starving scholar.
Yes.
The character.
Yes.
And he was like, I mean, that was certainly until he married. Well, that was rather the image of him. And I think that before he married, I mean, some years before he married, his friends were rather worried about him. I mean, they thought that he was getting very, you know, that he was talked till 3 and 4 in the morning, and that he was compulsive, and also that he was a great gossip. He also had the reputation.
Yeah.
There's a nasty remark about him in Journey to Iceland, whatever that book is called, by Auden and
Maurice. Oh,
and
saying that he's a gossip.
Saying a saucer of, for Isaiah Berlin, a saucer of milk. That's the line.
Yes, yes.
And that's by McNeice, I think.
Yes.
And in fact, Isaiah never forgave McNeice.
Yes, for that remark.
For that, no. So, and I think that Isaiah is extremely sensitive and really very frightened, quite frightened of any kind of public role in which he might be sneered at. I mean, I think that way he's extremely sensitive. I think he probably minded that attack by Scruton, but he would have minded much more when he was young.
Yes. Let me ask you a little bit about politics. Your own visits to Germany, or obviously the Spanish Civil War, the whole, you're plunged in that question from a very early period. But is Isaiah similarly gripped by what's happening to Europe in the 30s? And in the same way, do you think? Do you feel a kindred spirit with him, at least at level of interest? And
well, on the level of interest, yes. But but I suppose, I'm sure that Isaiah is everything one means by a liberal, as in his thought and thinking. He must have been. I remember one thing that we discussed quite a lot. So we went to Salzburg once or twice together, and you see, a kind of topic would be 1933-1934, what would Austria be like if the Nazis came? Well, you see, to Isaiah, this was, it's difficult to think what his attitude was. It was simply what had happened to all the Jews, and how could Austria manage? How could there be Salzburg without, I don't know, Elisabeth Schumann, Lotte Lehmann, Bruno Walter, all these Jews? But he did seem to have a very detached attitude about this. I mean, I wonder about Isaiah. I mean, I can't think, how did he react, say, to the concentration camps or something? I mean, horror, shuddering horror, but I don't think whether it stirred any sort of any feeling that he ought to do something about it, or what could one do about it?
In effect, you suspect him of a kind of he's a liberal in the Mandarin sense, of slightly more detached than he ought to be.
Well, I wouldn't say that he ought to be. I mean, in a way, that's his strength, isn't it? That he's a sort of outsider, but who has the same feeling, has feelings about the same things as I have feelings about. But I mean, during this anti-fascist period, I would think that one had to be rather active about it. But I don't think Isaiah ever did think that. So how much did he care? I don't know.
Can you remember a stand-up row with him on this question?
No. What he did care about, certainly hatred of communism in the Russian form, would be very, very strong and greatly intensified when he was in Russia during the war. I mean, he's told me quite at the how when he was in Russia at the British Embassy, he'd lie awake at night thinking what if it suddenly turned out that he lost his British citizenship and went back to be a Russian, what would he do? He'd kill himself quite seriously. And he decided he'd kill himself. And he did think that the Russian regime was the most horrible regime, and I don't know in history, but the most horrible modern regime there was. He thought that very seriously. Well, it may be because he thought, and maybe all my kind of anti-fascism and so on seemed to him rather superficial compared with his knowing exactly where he stood about these things. And not, I mean, intellectually and emotionally and everything, and having a much stronger intellectual grasp than I would have had, you see. And also, a very firm conviction, a very clear idea of where he was placed and what was required of him, that he couldn't, that he wasn't cut out to act about this.
What do you mean, not cut out?
Well, rather like you might decide that you're not, that you may sympathize with a cause, but you may decide that you're not cut out to be a sort of a soldier for freedom or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. I'm interested in this because you describe a friendship that contains within it quite substantial disagreements over matters of principle. That is, you are much more sympathetic to what the Bolshevik Revolution is trying to do in the early 30s, especially when set against the background of the fascist threat. Isai is adamantly anti-communist in a way that you're not. He's somehow more detached from the fascist menace than you are. But somehow this never comes to the surface of your friendship. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think, you see, in that way, we're always being attacked. I was just reading a book by C.H. Sisson the other day. We're always being attacked. Auden and myself and various other people. For having been communisant, having had these very strong views, but actually never having in any way, because we had these views, attacked intellectual fascism, or I say T.S. Eliot's, actually probably Isaiah feels more strongly about T.S. Eliot's anti-Semitism than I do. And I think simply is because I made a division in my mind between the political and the literary, always placed the literary above the political. I mean, after all, when we were young, members of my generation, the writers we admired were T.S. Eliot and James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, writers like that. And they all came out of the First World War and were strongly anti-political. So that to them, literature meant anti-politics. And politics meant death to literature. I mean, even D.H. Lawrence, I think, although there's sort of a lot of messy politics in his writing. And so I don't think that I could quarrel with anyone whom I admired in so many other respects about politics. I wouldn't really feel, I wouldn't feel at all critical of Isaiah, and I'm sure I didn't at any time feel at all critical of Isaiah for not being openly anti-fascist. Or I thought, in fact, I always thought that being an anti-fascist was rather vulgar, really. But I just thought that one ought to be, and one had to be.
And presumably a corollary of that set of beliefs about politics and literature would be a set of corollaries about temperaments, that certain temperaments
yes.
are just different. yours
yes.
different from his.
Yes.
Can you remember conversations with him during the period when you went to Spain, or before you went to Spain? Can you remember what you, whether he, you said at the outset that he had a kind of protective attitude towards
well,
you,
I'm
and I'm
sure.
wondering whether this came out over the Spanish.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that during the Spanish Civil War, I was very obsessed by it, and I'm sure I talked a great deal about it. Mm. And he was always sympathetic, but I think he always, you know, regarded me like as like someone who sort of goes out, has an impulse, you know, like a sort of mechanical mouse or something, to to go out and do silly things, really.
Yeah.
And that, which I think he would be very clear that I was. He did say to me once or twice, "Well, you know, you're not. You're quite unsuited to all this. You're not that kind of person at all." So I think he probably had some clear idea of what kind of person I was, which made all these kind of activities like a sort of automatism of a kind of mechanical toy that. sort of is. But
yeah.
wasn't the real person, I think.
Yeah. Did you suspect there was any truth in his assessment of you?
Yes, because I've always thought that all power... I mean, perhaps I should make clear... I mean, I belong to a very public family, because my father was a journalist,
Absolutely,
my
yeah.
two or three uncles were journalists.
Yeah.
And... I've always despised that. I mean, I despise it in them, and I despise it. But nevertheless, I have that sort of side of me, which I think is vulgar and sort of public. And so that, and I think that my friends have really always, you know, felt that, well, that was a side of me they could ignore, or something like that. And who would I... I mean, if I knew, say, Arnold Toynbee, I wouldn't take on a Toynbee's politics very seriously. I mean, I'd,
yeah.
basis in my respect would be that he was a historian. And also, I think that's again is why I've never really felt any kind of political criticism of T.S. Eliot was to the point at all, because this was something superimposed. On the Eliot who cared about poetry.
Mm. Except presumably you get into limit cases like Ezra Pound, where he tips into something else, where an unquestionably wonderful poet says some unquestionably awful things, and somehow the awful things do kind of scratch the template of the poetry a bit, don't you think?
Well, I've never felt he was unquestionably a wonderful poet.
Oh. Well, occasionally. That's another story. I'm wondering whether you could, moving in and out in this period in the 30s, describe your visits to Salzburg with Isaiah, what you did, how you traveled, where you went, what you saw, and what he was like as a traveling companion.
Oh, well, he was always great fun, very good. And, I mean, we were not at all extravagant, you know, we didn't have... I mean, we had a kind of student standard of life, I think. I mean, Isaiah was really like, an Oxford student, not exactly perhaps a poor student, but we really didn't care very much what we ate or
yeah.
what sort of hotels we went to, or what class we travelled, and all those things that you know you get very stuck with when you get older. But
was this kind of 3 weeks in August?
Perhaps three weeks in August. Yes. Right. I don't think Isaiah had a very strange friend. What's he called? very diminutive boy. I can't remember his name.
A Russian?
No, English. Mm-hmm. Who was almost like a sort of page, always going around with that. Very, very sweet, very, very nice, but somehow a person who, the kind of person who, and I think he may have done this, who goes and marries a waitress and sort of disappears from your mm-hmm. life altogether.
Can you remember his name?
No, but I think as I feel vaguely troubled about Michael Crawley.
Michael Crawley.
Yes. I think Azar feels vaguely uneasy about the whole thing.
Why? But
I don't know why. But anyhow, but the point is that I think that actually Azar was always with Michael Crawley. Mm-hmm. And with Michael Crawley, he was rather like a kind of page boy or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. But really very understanding, a person who understood Azar mm-hmm. very, very well and adored Azar. And then somehow disappeared from Isaiah's life, and from all our lives, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. So you travelled in a threesome, in fact.
I think that when we were, that's what I was really saying, is that Isaiah was much more with Michael already than with me mm-hmm. all that time.
Can you remember what you listened to in Salzburg?
Yes. Well, we listened to Don Giovanni. We also listened at one time, at 1 year, to Toscanini doing Meistersinger. Mm-hmm. We went to a great many, of course, all the concerts and things, as well as the operas. Fidelio, Toscanini's Fidelio.
Now I can imagine you in a pair of shorts, or even, God knows, lederhosen. I can imagine you in climbing boots, kind of athletically disappearing off, but I can't imagine Isaiah doing any of that. I imagine him only in kind of almost suits and in any kind of summer setting. You remember what he wore, what he looked like when he was on holiday?
Well, yes, he was always in suits. He certainly wasn't in lederhosen. and he certainly wasn't in shorts. I don't think I was, as a matter of fact. Yes, I think he probably a tweed suit. I don't think that he went in for Oxford bags and that kind of thing. He may have, but I don't think he did.
Yes.
He was always demurely dressed.
Demurely dressed. At what point in your pilgrimages to Salzburg did you feel Nazism very close, from the beginning, from 1934?
I was in Germany, so...
Yes, you'd been in Hamburg.
In 1932, 1930, 1931, 1932, I think. So, of course, I felt it very strongly. I didn't feel it so much in... certainly not then in Salzburg in 1929 and 1930. Mm. I mean, that seemed rather an escape from it, really. But it was always imminent, I mean, really externally and also internally, because of the sort of Austrian lederhosen all that side.
Yes. What other English folk did you meet in Salzburg in the summers?
Well, there'd be other people, I think. I was trying to think, you see, who Isaiah was, apart from us. There were two or three friends of ours, all from Oxford. I don't know whether Bernard Spencer would be. I really didn't meet anyone. I think there were one or two Americans. There was someone called James Loughlin,
yes.
who became
the publisher.
But I really didn't know him.
Yes.
I didn't know any of those American composers at that time. Because this was very early, you see. This would be 1930, 1931.
Yes, yes. I may be talking about a later period. Are all your Salzburg trips in that very early period of Isaiah?
I think so, yes.
Yes. So he goes to Salzburg through the 30s.
Best one was in 1932, which would be... because there was one when we would talk about what had happened to Austria. But it seemed very unreal. It wasn't until 1934 when I was actually living in Vienna when it seemed imminent.
Yes, that's under the Dollfuss.
Dollfuss time.
It's a terrible shame if your letters to Isaiah in that period are lost. That would be terrible. Are you sure that this is the case?
No, I'm not. I'm not sure.
Where might they be?
Well, we have a room in the house called the Bottomless Pit.
Right. And they might be in the Bottomless Pit.
They might be in the Bottomless Pit, yes.
Yeah.
I really would have to hunt through everything. I'm pretty sure they must be somewhere, but I know they're not filed.
Are other of your correspondence?
Yes, other correspondence is filed.
Is correspondence from Isaiah to Isaiah after the war filed?
Yes, but it wouldn't amount to yes, some of it. But it would, I think it's probably it's all. I don't think I've thrown anything of Isaiah's away. But it wouldn't be significant. Mm-hmm. Some during the war was. Mm-hmm. He wrote when he was at the British Embassy in America.
Yes.
And he was rather unhappy, I think.
Mm. Oh, really? Did you get a feeling he was unhappy?
But he hated America, yes.
Really?
Yes, a lot of the time, yes.
Hated, that's a strong word.
Yes, I remember him writing saying that all Americans look like knees.
Look like?
Knees, yes.
Yes. God. Because it was a very good time for him in lots of ways.
Well, there were various times. I mean, I think when he was at Harvard, perhaps he hated America. Was he at Harvard or what? I think he was at Harvard.
Oh.
Perhaps he liked when he got to the embassy.
Yes, yes. We're jumping ahead slightly. I'm just wondering whether you can, after you go down from Oxford or in London and you've come back from Spain, I'm wondering what your contacts were with Isaiah in that period, sort of 37 to the war.
But I always saw
seeing him and...
Yes, I... Of course, you see, I mean, I think the difference between my early contacts with Isaiah and later ones is that saw Isaiah alone. Imagine occasionally I see him alone now. I mean, I had lunch with him last week and I have lunch with him tomorrow. But one does have the feeling, though, that Isaiah is kind of surrounded and very open to to lots of visitors, doesn't one?
Yeah.
And so that you can go, you know, you can make I remember Nicholas Nabokov used to complain bitterly about this, that he'd make a pilgrimage to go and see Isaiah and couldn't get him alone for a single moment.
Really?
See.
Yes.
But even if physically one can get him alone, one does feel that he's not this sort of lonely, that he's somehow been parceled himself out into sort of morsels.
Yes.
And that you don't have the same kind of relationship with him, which I don't I really don't mind at all, but there it is.
Did you begin to feel that in the late 30s?
Yes, I think so, yes.
Did you go up to All Souls to see him at all?
Oh yes, quite often.
Did you stay?
I don't think I stayed with him, but I stayed probably at Oxford, yes.
Yeah. The picture you create of him is interesting to me in lots of ways. The image that what he is now, he very much was in the 30s already. So I suppose the most substantial element of what you're saying, that is extremely talkative, extremely expansive, confident in public, if less confident in private, with most of his political views in place, very much formed. I mean, is that a sort of summary, or an accurate summary of what you're telling me?
Yes, but I think there was a period when he became rather sort of when he had a lot of relationships, when he had relationships with people, for instance, Elizabeth Byrne, I think, which was sort of disturbing in a way, I think, and I think when he was. And then when he'd go on talking sort of compulsively, and you know, you felt he was afraid to be alone, and yet he didn't have any particular relationship with anyone. And sometimes he got sort of half entangled or entangled.